Hello, and welcome to the Rooted in Reliability podcast, your plant performance podcast, where we dive deeper into asset management techniques and know-how. I'm your host, James Kovacevic, and I will be your guide to achieving industry best practice. The Rooted in Reliability podcast is here to provide you with the insights to improve plant performance and deliver bottom-line results to your organization. In case you missed the last episode, you can find the Rooted in Reliability podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and on the reliability.fm network. Don't forget to subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. Now let's dive into today's topic. Hello, and welcome to the Rooted in Reliability podcast. I'm your host, James Kovacevic, and I'm here with Fred Schenkelberg. How are you, Fred?
Hey, pretty good, James. Good to hear from you today.
Thanks, Fred. Thanks for making time for us today. Hoping you could provide some insights for us around spare parts. Specifically, how does reliability data, how does failure data help us improve our spare parts stocking strategy? And how do we decide what spare parts we need to stock based on reliability data, failure mode effect analysis, so on and so forth? Just looking for some insights you've seen over your career on what are some of the best practices out there around the more advanced portion of stocking spare parts.
That's a big question. I mean, I was in the Army. I was in a supply battery for an artillery battalion, and I had to run fuel and food and bullets out to the rest of the battalion. And this is my introduction to supply chain management and to stocking spares, because we had, I don't know, 800 or 900 vehicles in the battalion, and we were in charge of the second level of maintenance for all of those things. So we had to carry all the tools and all of the equipment and spare parts and so on. And we were very constrained just by the vehicles we had, because we had to be mobile. But what struck me was the military procurement system, which didn't make sense to me then and still doesn't make sense to me today. And I'm sure there's organizations that do this. I haven't seen it in the wild, but I know it probably exists. Is at the end of the quarter or at the end of the year, and the way the military budgets worked was it's use it or lose it. And if you had a budget for, say, $250,000 and you only spent $200,000 because you didn't do as much stuff, or you were better at the maintenance program and we didn't need to use the spare parts, they would cut our budget. And so next year we'd only get $200,000 independent of how much we actually needed. And so my supply sergeant would fill out a whole pile of requisitions for all the things he thought we might need in the next year. He would burn the rest of the budget for the next year.
It's sad to say that is still quite common in many of the organizations I deal with. They still do the exact same thing.
That's sad. It really is. I mean, spare parts cost money, and they don't survive well. They rot, I think, is the technical term for them, right? I've seen spare parts of gearboxes and great big chain gears for equipment and all kinds of interesting components that were pretty unique just rusting away. And they're not used very frequently. They have long lead times, so you need some of them. But they didn't need to buy 10 when they only really use one every 5 years. And so 9 of them were just going to rust before they ever got a chance to use them. That's kind of what I see as a big issue, is having a policy or a strategy to step through your stocking list, basically, and say, do I need this or not? You know, can I get it on a reasonable amount of lead time? If I recognize I need this particular equipment or spare, can I get it before the equipment breaks down or before I have to do the maintenance on it? Versus it's such a lead time and the downtime is cost prohibitive, then I need to store it, and then I need to invest to store it properly. But then there's a whole nother category of just our ongoing regular use stuff we use fairly often. And then it's a balance of, well, how many do I need and how much do they cost? And then you throw in the constraints of space and storage and all those other things on top of it. And it's dealing with your particular storeroom is, well, yeah, I can stock plenty of nuts and bolts and washers and stuff like that, the simple stuff. But when it becomes, say, a $100 motor, and I go through 10 of those a month on average, with give or take some number, a little bit of analysis there can, combined with what your lead time and purchasing policies are, you can then calculate what's the right number of spares to hold and then track that, monitor it. But I see way too many programs that are either the military style. If you have an experienced supply sergeant, you probably are going to have way more tents and sheets and pillows than you will ever need. But on the other hand, I also have seen where it's just anecdotal. They have almost no spares. They order what they need when something breaks, and then the equipment's down. Or they order anecdotally. Oh, yeah, we used three of those last year. Let's get three more.
You mentioned a key piece of information there, lead time.
Mm-hmm.
Many organizations I work with do not know the lead time of a spare part. They don't even know what they consume on a, say, yearly basis or, you know, over the last month or so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, how they set up min and maxes is essentially, oh, I think we're going to use two this month, so let's order four as a minimum, and then we're going to double that, and that's our max.
Yeah, they don't. Yeah, it's, you know, when you got a 1,000 parts you got to stock, that's better than nothing. At least they have a policy in min max, right? They're still running a very serious risk of running out of parts or having way too many.
And I think having too many is almost as bad as not having enough.
Well, it ties up capital. You're putting money on the shelf, and you're going to lose some of that. It's just going to rot.
Exactly. And that's what I see. It's either it becomes obsolete due to the pace of technology change, or it rots.
You know, or it
I
gets remember, lost. It just gets buried in the back of the house. Yeah.
I was at a site not too long ago, and 12-inch valves, big gearboxes that, you know, are probably $50,000 to $60,000 outside,
mm-hmm.
rusting away, brand new.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, why are these outside in the elements? Well, we have 10 in the storeroom. We don't have room for it.
Yeah.
Well, then why do we have these?
Yeah. Ship them back. You know,
yeah.
Give them back and let somebody else use them. If they won't give you money back, at least recycle them. You know, whatever. But yeah, I've seen exactly the same. And it doesn't take that much work. And what I've seen is organizations will put parts into three different buckets, the nuts and bolts category and stuff they use on a regular PM basis. That stuff just gets kitted automatically. And you let the vendors restock your bins, for example. Those things are pretty obvious because you're just using a bazillion of them and they cost almost nothing compared to the $50,000 valve, for example. The middle stuff is, you know, $100 up to a couple thousand dollars and kind of in that range. And they're not hard to store, but you have to pay attention to how many you use per month. And it will vary every month. So by paying attention to that amount of variability and your lead time, I think the two critical pieces to that is you get down to say, we'll use four, and say your supply team there was accurate with their guess saying four is good stock. Will I use the remaining ones I have, the remaining four that I have, before the order shows up, right? And then the purchasing decision is often based on if I buy four, I get a discount, or if I buy five, I get a discount, or if I combine that with lead time, if I ship it the slowest route, it saves me, you know, 20% on the overall purchase. So all of those things get factored together. There are equations and different ways to think through those things, but that's the idea, is I want to calculate the chance of not running out of parts before the new parts arrive. And that's where that lead time comes in, is because just because they place the order doesn't mean it's going to show up tomorrow afternoon.
Yeah, exactly. And you mentioned it, you know, covering that period between when it's ordered versus when it arrives. That's where safety stock comes in. And is it predictable? What is the consequences of not having that spare? There's all those things that come into effect too. What is the proper min-max levels?
Mm-hmm.
What safety stock we're going to use. And then if you really want to take it a step further, then you look at economic order quantities.
Yep.
What is the cost of purchasing versus the cost of holding over the course of a year for this particular part, right?
Right, right.
And it's finding that balance of not stocking too much, but not ordering the same thing every week, because ordering costs money, right?
It does. I remember when I first started in industry, it was a purchase order cost $1,000 just for the paperwork and people to monitor it and process it and track it and make sure the payments were made. And, you know, so it didn't make sense to create a purchase order for $20. So we had petty cash for things like that. But when you start looking at the overhead costs that go into these purchase orders, you don't want to order individual motors at $100 each on a purchase order. You're going to kill yourself doing that.
You know, if I look at most organizations now with, you know, computers and those sorts of things, I hear anywhere purchase orders from $75 to $150 to process. So you have to take that into account every time you do one. And then, you know, what is the cost to maintain that inventory? Well, on average, it's roughly 2% per month of your total inventory value. And that includes, you know, the time to stock check, the time to cycle count, the time to receive stuff, put it away, you know, it's basic
real estate costs too.
Exactly.
That. Yeah.
So all those things come together and it adds up quite substantially. So making small improvements in spare parts can make a big difference to the bottom line.
Well, the other part, you know, when we're talking about spares and ordering, is it's not necessarily just the ordering process and getting parts there. It's also, do you have the right parts? It goes back to, what do you actually need? Now, some things we can forecast. We know that we're doing regular maintenance, where we are doing regular measurements and checks, and we can say, oh, next month we got to replace this and this and this, these three things. And then the trick is that sometimes we have to replace it pretty quick. We do an inspection when we realize this is cracked or it's leaking or it's damaged and it's going to take the line down if we don't fix it fairly quickly. So maybe next week. That's when having those kinds of spares immediately available. But the variability of those, of the use of those things, is really, really high. It starts really pushing the idea that we need a lot of different kinds of components and pieces to keep our equipment running just in case. But the stocking levels on those is generally pretty low. And so it's lots of ones and twos kinds of things. So being organized, I think the worst storeroom I saw was basically everything came in off the trucks and was just kind of shoved in. And the stuff that we didn't use right away was shoved further back and got buried deeper and deeper into where they just didn't know what they had anymore. And, you know, somebody go, well, I thought we ordered one of those things, but they didn't have the time to dig through the pile. I mean, literally a pile of equipment and boxes and stuff. And so they'd order another one and the equipment would be down for a week waiting for the order to show up.
And, you know, it's funny you mention that, because even with well-run storerooms and organizations that take it seriously, there always seems to be a back room with that very thing. You know, it's the hey, we replaced this, but just in case, we're going to throw it in this back room.
Yeah, look in the back of a truck sometime, you know, or especially when you have mobile repair teams that are out dispersed, kind of a operation. But even the carts and the bins or the toolkits that the technicians take out into the factory, there's inventory in there that's unaccounted for, that they know they need it and they restock themselves. They have like this shadow stocking system.
The best name I've heard for that so far is squirrel stores.
Yeah.
Like a squirrel, you grab a nut, you hide it just in case you need it again.
That's right. You know, and sometimes you open up a kit and there's one or two extra pieces, you know, or it's different configurations. So you end up with this coffee can full of random parts. One factory I was at, we actually named all of those and enlisted them into the storerooms. We put them into the storeroom system. And so if Bill needed something, but George had it in his toolbox, we had a rough idea. It wasn't perfect by any means, but we had a pretty good idea that where it was, and it helped to minimize that effect. But there's just that practical side. If you can't trust the storeroom to have that part for you, I'm going to keep it over in my locker.
Yeah, and it's a vicious cycle, because part of the reasons why I find that happens is, you know, the guys, oh, I need one for this job, I'm going to grab two just in case. They throw one in their toolbox, all of a sudden the storeroom now runs out because we consume two instead of one when normally it's one every so often. So now we're behind. Next guy comes up, he runs out, or he doesn't have it. So he does the same thing. So to me, it's a vicious cycle, and trying to address some of that. We need good processes in the storeroom, but we also need some of that trust to maintain those processes that we put in place.
Yeah, so. I totally agree. And it's the more trust that the shelf will have the part you need when you need it. And I think there's the secondary part, is that when you take that part out into the line, it will work. It will come out of the package and it'll be fine. So it's a combination of getting quality spare parts, but also installation procedures. You're not likely to damage it. And then third is that it's the right part, all those factors. I saw it once where these guys were climbing utility poles, and the kits were notoriously bad from the vendor. And so they'd carry three of them up there with them because they didn't want to have to climb up and down the pole three times.
And, you know, building on that, you mentioned having the part come out of the storeroom. That's good. and in working condition. What I see a lot of is the way some people troubleshoot is they just start replacing parts until it works. So they may have replaced five different components. All of a sudden the machine starts. Well, now they have these five components. They don't know if they're good or bad because they just replaced them. So what do? They bring them back to the storeroom and return them, not knowing if they're good or bad.
Right. Here's the parts. And they all look good.
Exactly.
On the outside. But the storeroom, I mean, a world-class storeroom will have a way to evaluate them, to do a test or to check out the parts and be able to determine whether they're good or not. But that's expensive.
It is, but so is the lost opportunity cost.
Oh, it is. It is. And it's a balance. I think the downside of that scenario is that if you replace five parts every time, you're going to end up with a 20% bad parts in your storeroom. Then people are going to start taking two of things, and all of those scenarios start playing out where you're also losing time. But knowing that you restock with good parts, I think it's a critical step, but it certainly can be avoided by avoiding the shotgun replacements. Improve the diagnostics of whatever you're doing up front. Long run, I think that really does save time. Might be a subject for another discussion. It's a little off of spares, but...
Yes, I think so.
This podcast is brought to you by Iridicio. Be sure to check out iridicio.com for a free copy of their ebook, A Smarter Way of Preventative Maintenance. This ebook will allow you to review your current maintenance program and eliminate the non-value-added work you are doing, which is most likely causing you more downtime than it is preventing. www.iridicio.com.
So staying on track with spares, how do you select the right spares? Do you use failure data to select the right spares to stock? Do you base your stocking on, say, a failure mode effect analysis or a reliability center maintenance analysis? How do you select the right ones?
Well, if it's brand new equipment, you almost always get a stocking list or a recommended list from the vendor and the opportunity to buy a bunch of spare parts. So if you got nothing else, that's the starting point. A little bit of experience and so on starts to collect the data that you need in order to do it. The trouble is that if you lose a gearbox that should have lasted 15 years for you and costs $100,000, you're probably not going to have an extra one of those online. But if your operation can't afford to be down during that lead time, well, then you better have an extra gearbox on hand, even early, because failures can happen any time. I think it's complicated as to what data you use, but you have to collect the data. So every time we replace something, every time we repair something, every time we install something, that has to be recorded because we need when it was put into service and when it was taken out of service and whether it failed or not. And that basic data allows us to do something like a Weibull distribution for that class of parts. And then it allows us to know what our expected failure rates are at various points in time. And that's a critical piece that goes into that calculation as to how many spare parts do I need next month? Because if the failure rate is changing, if all of my PLCs are wearing out, you know, I might have two replacements this month and four next month and then eight the month after that and then 16 and so on. It might just escalate because they're all just wearing out. So having some tracking of the data sets on those things and understanding the rate of failure change, or the changing failure rate, I should say, is a critical piece to that. But it starts with the record keeping. When did it get installed and when did it get replaced?
I have to agree, because if you don't know what you're using, why it's failing, you can't run the Weibull. You don't know if it's wearing out, if it's random, your failure rates, all those various things that go into this. One of the approaches I've seen in the past is very similar to a failure modes effect analysis. What is the probability of this occurring? What is the severity if this fails? And then for detectability, they look at how likely are we able to detect this? But they base their ranking on lead time to failure, I guess, is the best way to put it.
Yeah, if I notice a crack and it's the only time I see it is any crack at all means I have to replace it. I have to shut down the equipment. Then there's no lead time. There's no advance warning. But if I'm looking at, say, a chain stretch, or I can measure the length of my chain and the gap length and watch it progress over time. And if it's a steady use piece of equipment, I can see that it'll give me 2-3 months of warning of when it needs to go. So this whole idea of prognostic health management, of monitoring the equipment to forecast far enough in advance that then I can order and schedule the maintenance program, it only works for certain kinds of failure mechanisms. If you get a lightning strike and it wipes out a bunch of your electrical panel, well, there's no warning, there's no inspections ever going to catch that. You're basically screwed. It depends on the failure mechanism. Can I catch it in the inspection? So an FMEA, by looking at that detection level, can say, for the things that are really severe, they shut my line down if it fails, but I can't tell if it's going to fail and when. The nature of the failure mechanisms is undetectable. Well, that's a good case to hold that part, holding a $50,000 part in stores for 10 years is cheap insurance when it shuts the factory down for a week or 2 weeks or even a month.
And that's the categorization of spares. You have your insurance spares, you have your stock spares, I guess, and then your consumables.
Yep.
So each class has to be treated a little bit differently based on the consequences of not having it to your organization.
Yeah, but it also comes in, even in your insurance spares, you have to look at what's the risk of it not being available. It's rust or corrosion or creep or it's deterioration as it's in the storeroom. I live in a small community and we draw water from a surface creek nearby and treat it. And our main pump that took water from the treatment plant back up to the water tanks was leaking, was old. It was like 25 years old. It was just one of those rock solid old pumps. But I looked at it and I'm not an expert in water pumps, but that doesn't look right. It's vibrating like crazy. It's making all kinds of weird noises. I don't know why we're still using it. And before I could convince the board to spend the money to get a new high efficiency pump purchased and installed and get the old one refurbished or retrofit or whatever to have as a spare, the old pump failed. So the water master, he's off in Central Valley, California, trying to scrounge up a pump that would fit, any pump that would fit. So he shot the whole budget doing an emergency buy to replace this pump. So just came from a meeting with his team a couple days ago this weekend, and they decided that they're going to buy another pump, the high efficiency pump, change it over because of electricity savings, all kinds of other benefits, and keep the one that they had just bought, which is only a few months old now, in line with it as a backup pump. So they have two pumps capable of running the system, but one of them is just a whole lot more efficient. So they've just decided to have that spare on hand because it really did cost us way too much money to do a random emergency buy. And it's one of those I told you so kind of stories where it's like, come on, you guys.
Yep. But you mentioned maintaining that spare because you don't want it to deteriorate, rot, so on and so forth. One of the things that I find people fail to do is they fail to perform maintenance on their spare parts. You can't take a 50 horsepower motor, sit it on the shelf or on the floor, and not touch it for 5 years.
Well, that's where I've seen, in a regular rotation type, like with these, what we're doing with these pumps, is they're going to set them up in parallel. And then the water master's got directions to run that secondary pump occasionally. Just make sure it's available and still working and exercise it. It helps with the lubrications. It helps with all the seals. It helps with everything. It's like a car. You don't want to just put it in long-term storage unless you do a lot of precautions for it. So I think it's the same with spares. Some things you can just put in the closet and store, but other things you can't. You need to oil it and maintain it or exercise it I'm thinking of a Microsoft operating system. If you don't turn it on once a month, it's going to take you 3 days to get all the updates included.
Yep, exactly. And like if I think of that large motor, for example, go in every so many months and rotate the shaft, 1.25 turns or 1.5 turns every couple months. That way you don't get brinelling on the bearings. You get the grease to move around a bit. You do those basic things and it'll maintain even in the storeroom.
That's right.
It doesn't require a lot of effort. It just requires that focus on it or that realization that we actually need to maintain spares even though they're not in use.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly right.
So in your experience with spare parts, what would be the one thing you could change in spare parts programs or how people stock spare parts?
Yeah, the magic wand question is set up your stocking policy based on the data, which I think is where the magic wand comes in, is collect and analyze the data. The CMMS systems are already collecting 90% of what we need. But with a little bit of training with our technicians and with the teams that are inputting the data and a little bit of work, or customization, or just a, a little bit of thought of how do I pull out what I need. So if I want to know the history of this particular motor and is our maintenance program and use of this equipment wearing them out as we expect or worse than we expect, or are we doing good? Or is it doing better than we thought? You can't answer that unless you have good data. And so I think the key part is find at least one scenario where you have decent data and then show how valuable it is and use that as a springboard or a beachhead to convince the rest of the organization to collect and gather and use the data that they almost already have in most cases.
Yeah, I have to agree. It comes down to data. We want data-driven decision-making, not intuition guiding our spare parts stocking policy.
Yeah, I have heroes that I know of that were these super experienced, wonderful technicians and maintenance workers that they could lean up against the piece of equipment and tell you exactly what's wrong with it. You know, it's like the old auto mechanics that didn't need a computer to help you diagnose and fix your car. Our equipment's way more elaborate and complicated in many cases than it was 30 years ago. So we're not building experience as fast as we need to for this kind of equipment. And a lot of it, if it's vibrating, you better shut it down. Kind of stuff. If it's that bad. But yeah, if you want to do it right, you have to get the data. And it does take an investment to get it, but it will save you just boatloads of money going forward if you do use it.
Yep, absolutely. Now, do you have a resource that you'd recommend for people looking for more information in spare parts?
No, I don't. I taught a course some years ago, a couple of times for the, I want to say Rensselaer Institute of Technology, but that wasn't it. A friend of mine hooked me up into a course she had built on logistics and spares was a big part of it, and reliability was a big part of it. And between the two of us, we could not find a good textbook or a reference source for it. But that was about 10 years ago, so I'm not real sure anymore.
There's very few good ones that I have found. It's hard. I'll find good chapters in a few books, but that's it. It's a chapter. It's a brief overview. There's not a textbook on proper spares management. Like maybe that might be a future project.
Yeah, I was just thinking I was going to propose that you write it. But I've got course material, and I've got material that I think, and I know the calculations. What I should do is probably write some articles about it and get it put together. But given how much money it can save an organization when you get it right, and it does include a little bit of statistics and understanding the variability of shipping time, of your order time, or of all of those things vary, accounting for that and getting your stocking levels right where you don't run out of parts that you need and you don't have too many parts that are just expensive is nirvana. You really need good data in order to understand all that variability. And I agree with you, James. There's not a good textbook out there. So if somebody's listening and wants an opportunity to be a bestseller author and get on Oprah and all that good stuff, there's the book for you.
Now you set a goal, Fred. Now I got something to work towards.
Okay, great.
All right, Fred, I want to thank you for your time. So where can people find out more about you, what you're up to, and those sorts of things?
Well, the biggest project I've got going on is the Ascendo Reliability site, where it's a reliability engineering professional development hub. So we've got these podcasts, the podcast network under reliability.fm. We've got articles. I think we just crossed 500 articles on there. So the search engine becomes your friend at some point on there. But if you sign up on the site, you get a weekly update of everything that's new on the site and upcoming webinars, courses, articles, podcasts, things like that, so that you can stay fresh with your knowledge in reliability engineering. So ascendoreliability.com.
We'll make sure to include that in the show notes. Thanks, Fred. I appreciate your time, and I'm sure our listeners do as well. I look forward to talking to you again shortly.
Great. Thanks, James.
I would like to thank you for listening and remind you that you can always find out more on maintenance, reliability, and asset management at www.iridicio.com and by following our blog. The Rooted in Reliability podcast is a proud member of the reliability.fm network. I'd like to ask you to please rate and review this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. It ensures the podcast stays relevant and is easy to find by like-minded professionals. It is only with your ratings and reviews that the Rooted in Reliability podcast can continue to grow. I thank you for providing the small but critical support. We'll see you next week when we dive into another burning topic with Rooted in Reliability, your plant performance podcast.